The Secrets of Movies and TV Shows is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give.
You're listening to The Secrets of Movies and TV Shows. Today, we are discussing the show Gene Roddenberry's Andromeda. I'm Jeff Hecker, and joining me today is Victor Lambs. Hey, Victor.
Hi, Jeff.
And be sure to follow The Secrets of Movies and TV Shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, or your podcast app of choice. And you can also follow the show on the StarQuest YouTube channel. And please share the podcast with your friends. And you can also find us on social media at facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. We're on Twitter, where we are at SQPN, or on Instagram, we are at StarQuest Network. And as I mentioned, today we will be discussing the show Andromeda from, I believe it started in the year 2000 and ran until 2005. So we have a brief summary here, and then we'll just get into it. So thousands of years in the future, the system's commonwealth is the greatest civilization in history, encompassing countless worlds and three galaxies. The Nietzscheans, a genetically modified race of superhumans, rebel, and in a fateful battle, the High Guard ship Andromeda Ascendant and her captain Dylan Hunt are caught in the event horizon of a black hole. 300 years later, the Commonwealth has collapsed during the Long Night. The Nietzschean Empire is one of many factions vying for control until the salvage ship, the Eureka Maru, and her crew find and recover the Andromeda. Captain Hunt makes an offer to them to help him restore the Commonwealth, and along the way they contend with Nietzscheans, the carnivorous Magog, and plenty more threats. And eventually, at the very end, the Commonwealth is reestablished, and the lost capital world of Tarn Vedra is found, and peace is restored to the galaxies. So that's a brief summary of a 5-season TV show. So before we discuss further, Victor, we were talking beforehand, but what is your background with Andromeda? Did you watch it as it was coming out, or did you catch up on it later, or how'd you find it?
Yeah, I sure did. I watched it. It was a syndicated TV show, which meant you could find it on your local UHF station back when it originally aired. And I was a big fan of sci-fi. Star Trek Deep Space Nine was my favorite show. So when I saw that Robert Hewitt Wolf, who was one of the main showrunners for Star Trek Deep Space Nine, had this new show coming out, and it starred Kevin Sorbo, who I watched him on Hercules, A Legendary Journeys. So I started watching it, and this is just as I was like starting out as an adult, and it was a fun thing I could do. My dad also at the time was watching it, so we would sometimes talk about the episodes after they aired. He enjoyed the show. So I watched it as originally aired, and then when my dad passed away a few years ago, then part of that grieving process, I thought, I'm going to rewatch Andromeda. We used to watch it, not together, but we would talk about it, so I watched the entire run of the show with my own kids a few years ago. So it was just as enjoyable, I would say, the second time around. So there's a lot that I really like about this show. You have to meet the show on its own terms a little bit, I think, especially if you're a modern audience here 20 years later. But I really enjoy it. And I was just thinking I'm about due for another rewatch of it soon here.
Very nice. Yeah, I remember for myself, I watched it. I remember when it was first coming out, I'd been a Star Trek fan. I didn't really watch DS9 when it was coming out, but I'd watched Voyager. I'd seen a lot of Next Generation. I don't think I'd really watched any of the original series at the time, but I knew who Gene Roddenberry was, and I saw there was this new show coming out, and I was a little bit younger than you. I was going into high school at the time when it was coming out, and I had been a big fan of Stargate and all these other long running or 22 episode shows.
Yeah.
And so when it was coming out, I started watching it, and I think I probably kept up with it for the first 2 seasons, maybe. And I don't think I watched every single episode at the time. I think I just caught it when I could, and I fell off of it as school got busy and it was harder to keep up with. And so I didn't actually complete watching it until college several years later. And I did rewatch the entire thing. Been rewatching it over the last couple months because really since COVID started, I've been cycling through my old sci-fi TV shows and hadn't gotten to Andromeda yet. So started a few months ago and didn't quite make it all the way through. And to be honest, the last season drags for me. I don't know if you feel the same way, but which we can talk about. But yeah, overall, it's a fun show. And I hadn't seen Hercules, but I knew who Kevin Sorbo was. I'd seen some of Xena, but I'm actually have been watching Hercules. So getting that feel for Kevin Sorbo. And yeah, it's just a fun show. It deals with some heavy themes sometimes, but it's a lot of like episode of the week. They've got to solve a problem as a crew and kind of harkens back to that same thing, like Next Generation or Voyager kind of things. Different from modern sci-fi now, where it's, I know y'all talk about it on Stargate sometimes of how it's modern sci-fi can be super dark and things like that. But it's just a fun show to watch. And it just makes me miss these shows that had 20 episode seasons. And it's just something that you don't have to worry about running out of, where I know it's just a different time, but yeah, no, it's a fun show. And I guess obviously spoilers, full spoilers, if you haven't seen it and want to watch Andromeda as we talk about it.
Yeah, we'll try and keep the spoilers to a minimum, but there are some key points that I think we need to touch on in the show, including that fifth season.
Yeah, we can.
The show did have an interesting production history, which maybe we could touch on a little bit later, with Robert Hewlett Wolf leaving midway through the second season, then the production company going bankrupt at the end of the fourth season, and Sci-Fi picking them up, but at half the budget they had for the fifth season, which kind of explains some of the decisions they made there. But yeah, what I really love about Andromeda and this kind of genre or this era of sci-fi is that the shows didn't take themselves too seriously. There's a lot of humor in there. Granted, yes, you do have, you know, the carnivorous aliens that will, the Magog, which is one of the main threats, that will, you know, lay their eggs inside of you. And when they mature, they'll eat the way out of your body. And that becomes a major plot point, as one of the characters is actually impregnated with these eggs. And that's his greatest fear and what's going to happen to him. But mixed in with that, you have Kevin Sorbo, who's so affable and likable, at least to me, and so goofy at times. I think it's in season four, they're just, as one example, they're navigating the ship and the ship's been taken over, and he reaches into his secret compartment and pulls out his sword and his blonde wig from when he was Hercules and says, oh, really? Something like, he's like, oh, we don't talk about that, and puts them back or something. Just like goofy moments. Those are few and far between that they're actually that goofy, but there's humor, there's quips, there's the interplay between the main cast, which I think we should probably talk about, because they did put together a great ensemble cast for this, where each character has their own motivations, what's driving them, because they are not together at the start of the pilot. They're drawn together by circumstances. Robert Hewlett Wolf, after the show finished, wrote a one-act play that talked about what he wanted or what he foresaw for each of the characters and kind of the show in general. And it's a bit different than what we actually got in the show. And this is, he left the show because the producers, other producers, wanted the show to be more focused around the Dylan Hunt captain character, whereas Robert Hewlett Wolf saw it as more of the ensemble thing. So we get Kevin Sorbo as Dylan Hunt, and he plays this hero from a bygone era who's been trapped in stasis for 300 years and is suddenly brought out of it by basically like scavengers and thieves, finds out his whole world is gone. His wife or fiance is long dead. Everybody he knew is long dead. Civilization has fallen. And so he has to basically reconstruct it. And it's essentially, if George Washington was frozen in stasis, came out in 2024, and said, oh my gosh, I need to refound the United States of America or something, how would he go about doing that when all he has is one ship? Granted, it's a super powerful ship. How would he go about doing that when he needs to basically create a whole new federation, or commonwealth, as it's called in the show? It's a really compelling story, and it has ultimately a happy ending.
Yeah, I was almost thinking of it. It's almost what Enterprise could have been, like the Star Trek Enterprise, of building the Federation. I know there was stuff around the cancellation of it, but that could have been a pretty cool final season of kind of building the Federation. And so that you get that here, and it's doing it better than Star Trek Discovery has been doing it, of rebuilding the Federation after a long period of history and whatnot. And it's funny, because I think when Harper, who's the genius mechanic hacker guy on the Eureka Maru salvage ship, I think he calls Dylan Hunt, he's like a Greek god in the pilot, I think is what he says, obviously, harkening back to Hercules. So yeah, they do play up those humorous things. And Harper's kind of he's a comic relief, but he's not just comic relief. Like he rebuilds and upgrades the Andromeda, and the Andromeda is, as we haven't mentioned yet, has an AI. I guess all High Guard ships, or all the capital ships at least, have these AIs, and they can split themselves off into multiple different AIs, I guess. So I've always been a little unclear how that works.
It's very clever how it works. So the ship itself has a personality. And in this case, it's Andromeda Ascendant is the name of the ship. And so the ship's basic functions have a personality. So, and they're all played by Lexa Doig, who you may know from later seasons of Stargate SG-1, other shows as well. But so she'll pop up on the screens and basically say, my weapons are depleted, or they're penetrating the hull, that sort of thing. So that's one aspect. Then there's the more developed AI, which shows up as a hologram, and that's more of the friend and companion to the captain. It's meant to challenge the captain, provide insight, give the captain someone to talk to. And then you mentioned Harper, who is the genius. He is a human who grew up on Earth after the Nietzscheans and Magog have basically ravaged it. So he grew up in Boston. He's had to fight his entire life just to survive. He's part of the salvage crew that's come to get the Andromeda and its cargo of Nova bombs, which are the most powerful deadly weapon in the universe because they basically create supernovas. They could turn a planet into a star. He basically says, hey, wouldn't it be great if this ship's AI had an android body? So he creates an android named Rami. And so now the ship's personality can travel in this android, and Rami actually becomes a distinct character or personality from the Andromeda ship AI. So that's another really cool aspect of the show. So Lexa Doig is actually playing Andromeda, but has three different roles. One is the ship's status display. One is the ship's AI, who is a friend of the captain. And one is this android Rami, who has her own feelings and own motivations and desires apart from the rest of the ship. So yeah, and appreciate
she,
that.
There, yeah. She has some cool moments throughout the show. There's one episode where they encounter this, I guess it's a ship from Earth that was before the Commonwealth that was traveling near the speed of light. And so I think they're about to collide with the Andromeda or something. So they come out of light speed, and in the episode, Rami almost decides to go with this ship on this mission of exploration because it's there exploring the galaxy, but they're thousands. Cause I don't know if it's ever made clear, but this is thousands of years after our modern times, like 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, something like that.
Yeah. It's the year of the Commonwealth, like 10,000, but it's Earth, like 5,000 something. So yeah, the history of the Commonwealth, we'll go into that. It's really interesting the way they set that up.
Yeah. And unfortunately in the final season, I think she was pregnant at the time, Lexa Doig. I think it's why they gave her a reduced role and combined her with another character in a way. Cause she actually met Michael Shanks on set. Cause he played an AI. He played this like the AI of this destroyer type ship and who's wanted to just destroy everything, destroy all humans basically. And they got a little bit of a romance thing, but that's how Michael Shanks and Lexa Doig met for the Stargate.
Well, that's awesome. I didn't realize it was on the show here.
I'm pretty sure they met on set there.
And it was pretty interesting the way they handled that. First, I think they blew up the android at a certain point, but they kept her from like the neck up as like the ship's AI or something, because that wouldn't have shown the pregnancy too much. And then you're right, they did bring in Doyle for the fifth season, who's Harper's attempt to rebuild Rami, but using only the materials at hand on the planet they find themselves stranded on in the fifth season. So,
we also have Tyr Anasazi, who is a Nietzschean.
They are awesome.
Yeah, he's not initially on the crew of the Maru. He's because what it is this junk salvager guy who's trying to give the Andromeda to some warlord or something, and so he hires the Maru to do that. And they have these mercenaries in cold storage, and when they can't get the job, when they find out that there's someone on the Andromeda, which is Dylan Hunt, they activate the mercenaries who Tyr's in charge of. And he's a Nietzschean, the last survivor of his pride, because the Nietzscheans are like, they prize genetics and they mate based on who has the best genetics and who could produce the strongest offspring. And the males usually have multiple wives and stuff like that, but they call themselves prides as their family group. So, and he's the last survivor of one pride and eventually takes the place of the Like they don't really explain how this, and if I think about it too hard, I don't know if it really works, but the genetic reincarnation of kind of the first, Nietzschean.
Yeah. So the Nietzscheans have basically genetically isolated and enhanced themselves beyond, they started off as humans, but they've basically become a new race, and they are led by the teachings of Friedrich Nietzsche, the philosopher, which is the Superman, the strong survive and stuff. Yeah, the Übermensch. And so they are, and it leads to some really great, you're like, oh, imagine 5,000 years in the future if there was this race of superhumans who took Nietzsche as their Bible, what would they look like? And it's this, and it's great. And there's such a limited gene pool, I think, that eventually they genetically reincarnate to a previous version. So whoever has the mummified remains of the progenitor of the Nietzscheans, Drago Museveni, is the de facto leader of the Nietzscheans. So part of Tears Only on the Andromeda, because he wants to get or protect these mummified remains. And then he learns he has his son, and his son is the genetic reincarnation. So basically the leader, future leader of the Nietzscheans. So there's a whole plot with him, but eventually that actor, Keith Hamilton Cobb, wanted to do stage productions in New York. So I think he got a job on a soap opera and left the show. And they make a joke about him wanting to be young and restless in the show. And we get Steve Basic, who comes in as Telemachus Rade, who is basically the genetic reincarnation of the Nietzschean who betrayed Dylan 300 years ago. His best friend, best man, was going to be his best man at his wedding, but basically sold out not only Dylan, but the entire Commonwealth to the Nietzscheans and basically destroyed civilization. So Dylan has to come to grips with the fact that his new first officer is basically looks and sounds exactly like his old first officer, who was his best friend and betrayed him. And can he really trust this guy? But Steve Basic is, he's on Stargate, a number of other shows. He's excellent in this as well. And then we have two other characters who are probably, I think, the most interesting characters on the show. No, three other characters. We have Becca Valentine, who is the captain of the Eureka Maru, this scavenger vessel. And then Maru plays a big role in the show, helping out. Is she in it for the money? She is at first, but she signs on to the mission, Dylan's mission eventually. There were big plans for her in the show. She's there. And then probably my two favorite characters are Trance Gemini, played by Laura Bertram, who looks like a cartoon devil. She's initially purple with a tail that looks like a pointy devil tail, acts like a teenager, but clearly knows more about what's going on than meets the eye. And it's revealed later on that she can see potential futures, and we don't know why exactly this is the case, or why when one of the characters is passing out and barely conscious, he looks at her and sees a sun, you know, a star. And so we eventually learn more about what's up with her. And then we have Brent State as Rev Bem, or Red Plague, Bohemial Far Traveler is his Magog name. So he is one of these aforementioned stick Magog aliens that are horrible. They breed by the billions, take over whole worlds, lay their eggs in your stomachs, destroy, eat, maim. But he is adopted. He's basically a priest. He's adopted the religion of the Way. So he is a Wayist priest. And the Way can be thought of as a mixture of kind of Taoism, Catholicism, and maybe a few other religions, but it's the primary kind of religion. And so he's basically a peaceful monk, but he has to constantly fight his nature, which is he wants to eat his crew members. So there's
that
a kind of
comes to a head at times, because he has to kill in order to activate his digestion process. So I think they say he keeps a fish pond that lets him satisfy that. But there's an episode pretty early on where him and Harper are they're on a crash ship. They think the Maru crash or something, and he hasn't eaten because he was fasting. And so Harper has to lock him up so he doesn't give into his nature. But yeah, I think they say, or he says, that he attacked Earth or attacked wherever this one Wayist was. And I think either, you know, impregnated the Wayist or something. And while he was waiting for his offspring, the Wayist taught him the religion and he accepted it over that, however long it took. I can't remember if they say it takes like months or weeks or however long it takes for these larvae to burrow themselves out and or eat their way out of their host, basically. So he's, yeah, he is one of the most interesting, I feel like, as well. Him and Trance are, and they're the match pair because he's the wise one and she's the young, who's also knows wise in some ways, but it's really hidden a lot of the time. And yeah, he eventually leaves the show as well. I think a little bit before Tyr does, because I think the actor was tired of the makeup because it's like a pretty involved thing.
He was severely allergic to the makeup, as well as he's basically wearing this huge furry rug, and under the lights, it was like he was passing out from the heat. And then you see him, he's wearing full prosthetics. He looks like a bat because the Magog are basically bat people. And so they tried to give him a half human makeover so he could come back for a few episodes. One of the things that really sold me on the show was in the first episode, it appears that Trance has died. I think she's been shot by one of the bad guys. And Rev Bem actually says, may the divine grant unto her eternal rest and may perpetual light shine upon her. And at which point she revives. And when you learn in the fourth and then later in the fifth season, like who that character is and what she is, that line from the very first episode about perpetual light just makes so much more sense. So there's a lot of really nice moments like that. They were clearly trying to do something new, keep it positive, keep it upbeat with a lot of really good humor.
Yeah, it's a contrast to Star Trek in some ways, where it's so much focus on the science and not really any room for religion or faith. So I'm trying to think if there's other religions that they talk about. I think it's mainly the Weiss, but I think there's even an episode where there's this colony of Weiss followers and they're about to be attacked by I think they're attacked by Magog or something. And some of the Magog actually impregnate one of these Weiss, and Rev teaches them as they eat their way out, unfortunately, and that host dies, he teaches them to become protectors of these people. So it's an interesting, cause yeah, you see eventually you find out there's this Magog world ship of 10 planets around this artificial sun that's coming. It's the ticking time bomb that's coming to, attack the Commonwealth that's been rebuilt at this point. Cause I think it's in the second season they signed the charter of the Commonwealth and they rebuild it over.
Yeah, so they rebuild it. They get their 50 new worlds by the end of the second season. But the Magog world ship is coming, and at the heart of it is the spirit of the Abyss, who is basically, after Robert Hewlett Wolf left, it basically became like the spirit of evil. So it's the spirit of destruction and evil that exists outside of our universe, but it created Magog and is using the Magog as its agents of destruction. And there's this basically artificial solar system heading towards civilization that's going to completely destroy it. And if all this talk of like religion and faith, you're wondering, hey, isn't this Gene Roddenberry's Andromeda? I thought Gene Roddenberry didn't have much time for any of this stuff. And that's correct. The Gene Roddenberry is on the show, and Majel Barrett Roddenberry is listed, I think, as an executive producer. But really, the show is based on a couple of spec scripts he wrote in the 70s. Majel Barrett Roddenberry, I don't think, had much to do with the show. It was all reworked by Robert Hewlett Wolf and the other producers and writers of the show. So I think the Gene Roddenberry is on there just as a hook. I don't think he really had much of anything to do with the show, given that obviously it was made after he died.
Yeah. Okay. I hadn't really learned much of the backstory of it. But I think it's interesting because that the Roddenberry part, I think, this was a long time ago, but from what I remember, I think it's what got me into watching or at least giving it a chance, because I'd seen some Star Trek and I liked it. So it was a hook for me to get into the show. But yeah, are there any other characters we need to talk about before we move on to more plots? And each ones are interesting because you meet a bunch of them over the course of the show, and they all have these names after like famous dictators or generals, and they have an interesting way of saying how they talk. They're like, I am Tyr Anasazi. By, I forget his lineage, but you say out of the
Barbarossa.
Mom,
yeah.
By Barbarossa, out of whoever. Yeah. So, yeah. But you meet some interesting Nietzscheans and some of the other races too that we could talk about. There's the Perseids, who are Egyptian like guys.
Yeah.
The Egyptian Chin. They're usually scientists, I feel like. And I think in the show, it's hinted that they were maybe the ones that contacted humans in the long past and were the ones that Egyptian religion was or society was based on. I don't know more about that from I'm trying to remember, they might just reference it, but
yeah, I don't. They're comic relief, but they're also like the most technologically advanced, you know, just from like the science perspective. So when they pop up, it's usually something's going to go horribly wrong. The scientists, we have the Than, which are the insect race. The only real Than we see is Dylan Hunt's pilot. And I should mention that the ships and the technology at this point, the Andromeda is a really cool looking ship.
Yeah.
And what they did is they didn't, when you see ships fight in Star Trek, it's like you have the capital ships and they're basically swooping around like dogfighters trying to like shoot each other. And it's not very realistic. In Andromeda, they basically said ships this big would be an aircraft carrier. So Andromeda is equipped with slip fighters, which are manned fighters that are basically tiny versions of itself. And then also drones, missiles, point defense weapons. So it's a warship. And it can fire drones, it can fire lasers, it can put up plating, armor plating and stuff. Very cool. And the way that ships get around in this version of the future is through slipstream, which is a version of, it's a different space. It's hyperspace or subspace, but it's only navigable through certain routes. So to get from point A to point B, you might have to go through lots of different twists and turns. It looks like you're riding a roller coaster. And it's only sentient beings can navigate slipstream. AIs can't do it because they say that the act of choosing is what makes that path the right path to get to where you're going. So I don't know, like a Heisenberg thing, but only humans can navigate this. So it's a really cool kind of way that they get around. So some areas of space are just inaccessible because nobody knows the slipstream routes to get there anymore. For example, and that brings us to the mythical race, the ancient race, the Vedrans, who conquered their home galaxy tens of thousands of years ago, started the Commonwealth, eventually conquered a second galaxy, then moved into the Milky Way galaxy, where they encountered the humans. The humans spread out quite a bit, and so that's why most of the people they run into are human beings. But then the Vedrans, as part of the Long Night, when the Commonwealth fell, basically disappeared. And their homeworld has been completely cut off from the rest of space. So Dylan eventually learns that he's a Vedran, not a human. He grew up on Tarn Vedra, the Vedran homeworld. And so his quest then becomes, how do I get back home? As well as reuniting the Commonwealth. And the end of the fourth and beginning and the entire fifth season kind of deals with that quite a bit.
Yeah, and I think, and you actually do get to meet a Vedran because nobody's seen one for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
But there's an episode where they find one kind of survivor. They're kind of like horse people. They're like, yeah, they have a horse like body.
Centaurs, and, but, yeah,
they're fish, which is maybe it's another reference to Hercules. they're pretty cool race. But yeah, they're hinted at more than anything. You meet that one. I think that's the only like Vedran you meet that's actually in the, because they're like big blue horse people. So. Yeah, at the end of the fourth season, there's this map that everybody's trying to find that, and I'm in my rewatch, I'm right there getting into the, I remember how it all ends because but the fourth season, they're trying to find this map to unlock space and time kind of a thing. The route of the ages is what they call it in order to, I think ultimately the goal is to find Tarn Vedra, and the Spirit of the Abyss is also chasing them. And that's where Tyrion Asazi leaves the show as well because he's left the Andromeda and goes to work with these other factions because he's taken over as the Nietzschean savior because he kind of changes his genetic code to match the bones of Drago and Misevni so that he can lead the Nietzschean people. But yeah, we lose him along the way because he's the bad guy. So, or he turns into the bad guy. So, but his character overall, I thought was really interesting during the show because you never quite know what his motivations are or his motivation that he's out for himself, but you never know where his kind of loyalties lie beyond that. Because sometimes he's doing his own missions against the Nietzscheans. Sometimes he's partnering with Nietzscheans. Sometimes he's working against the Andromeda crew. Sometimes he's working with them, but for his own end. So
yeah,
he's constantly shifting and you never know, can you really trust him? And which just leads Dylan to not completely want to trust after his former friend and Rade and then the reincarnation Telemachus. He's had two Nietzscheans betray him, so he doesn't really want to give Telemachus a chance, who's on this like high guard, like bastion planet where some survivors, which I think led by Dylan's fiance, which I think that's Kevin Sorbo's wife.
Yeah, it is. Yep.
She founds this planet that's going to, and they eventually meet up with them to, and that's where Telemachus comes in and takes over that weapons officer spot on the crew and kind of the muscle, even though Dylan's a pretty big muscle too.
Yeah. And the characters are really what makes the show so enjoyable. Tyr, you never know. He's playing both sides against the middle. Dylan knows that Tyr is playing both sides against the middle and is subtly manipulating Tyr as well. There's a lot of things happening in the background. Harper, of course, probably my favorite. I keep saying every character is my favorite, but he's amazing as well. Only he's the weaker character. And so every time something bad and that needs to happen, it happens to Harper without fail. But there's an episode early on where I think he gets blasted with all this knowledge from a library or something. And he goes completely like mad with knowledge. And so in the ship's like hold, he starts building a model of the Bell X-1 jet plane that broke the sound barrier. He starts making double entendres in an ancient Celtic. And he just, Gordon Michael Wolvett just plays that character. So I think he won awards at the time for best actor in sci-fi. The show, of course, being made in, I think, Vancouver, Canada, we get a lot of the normal actors that you would see in Stargate at the time. Chris Judge shows up as a ship's AI. Michael Shanks, you mentioned. Kevin Sorbo's sidekick from Hercules shows up as a crazy ship as well. John DeLancey shows up as Becca's quote-unquote uncle. In a few episodes, Uncle Sid. Tony Todd shows up, as you mentioned, on the planet of, or that ship, the sublight ship that's traveling through space. So we get a lot of really good guest stars. And so if you're a fan of Stargate, you'll see many people that you recognize throughout. But yeah, and then end of the fourth episode, Dylan finds out he's a Paradyne, which is like a super special veteran. He goes through the route of ages. He sees himself coming out the other way. You're like, what does this mean? And then in season five, the show's picked up by sci-fi. They cut the budget down to $500,000 per episode. And we get a season that's basically filmed on a back lot as they're stuck on this desert planet, which is an artificial solar system where there's many copies of Tarn Vedra, the Vedran homeworld, orbiting an artificial sun. But eventually through all of that, his crew is all there, but is really upset at him. He reunites his crew, gets his ship back, defeats the evil stars that want to destroy everything. It makes sense more or less when you see it, when I say the evil stars, that the council of evil star, like literally stars that want to destroy everything. And then basically it ends with him saving the known universe and him getting some well-deserved rest at the end, which is no hero saves the universe, but sacrifices himself and his crew. Nope. It's a happy ending for basically everyone, except for maybe the planet Earth. And I throw that in there, but yeah. And yeah, so it's a rocky show, just given that they had characters like who were integral to the story leaving due to one issue or another and running around that. J. Michael Straczynski, when he did Babylon 5, had what he called trap doors, where it's okay, if my lead leaves at this point, I can bring in, if Sheridan leaves, or I can bring in, we're good either way. But Sinclair leaves, we can bring in Sheridan. But the showrunner leaves, they bring in some new showrunners, they leave, they bring in someone else, and the show continues on for five seasons. And I really enjoy it. Like I said, I think I'm due for a rewatch. It's overall very optimistic, very positive show, very good in terms of what Cormac McCarthy said in The Road, we're carrying the light, we're carrying the fire. In this case, the fire is civilization. And can one person in the right place at the right time rekindle the fire of civilization and bring it back to a universe or three galaxies, at least, that has fallen into disarray? And the message here is clearly, yes, one person can make a difference.
Yeah, he's definitely that messiah figure, but he's also, I'm not going to say too flawed, but he does have at times he's not perfect like you might see in some other things of this kind of nature. So, and he's, like I said, like you said, it's the ensemble that kind of makes it work. You have, whenever there's a problem, he sends Harper to figure out the technical side. And we haven't really talked about Becca much, but she's the captain of the Maru, and she's his executive officer on the Andromeda, even though I don't think she's ever commissioned into the High Guard or anything. She's just she has a warrant commission or something. And she's the ace pilot, and they use the Maru as a scout ship, or if they have to go make a deal up that they don't want them knowing it's the High Guard or something, they take the Maru,
which looks like a bucket of bolts, which is cool because you have the Andromeda, which is super sleek, and then you have the Maru, which looks like it's just being held together. It's the ship Becca inherited from her deadbeat father and has just been keeping it together, scraping by and stuff. And so so she's an ex drug addict, has a lot of history, is a CD past, but that actually comes in handy at times, or at other times it can be a liability.
Yeah, I feel like she's always running into someone from her past that recognizes her and, you owe me money, or you remember this job you pulled, you left me behind, or like you would in a criminal underworld, you always running into people. And I forget how they say she and Harper met, or maybe they never did, but yeah, Harper's kind of been with her for a long time, and he's just her younger brother along for the ride, but has the technical skills, and he has that cool, I forget what they call it, but just it's like a Matrix style, like jack that he can hook into a computer system, and he can talk to Andromeda within the Andromeda, or that's how he uses to do a lot of techie stuff.
Yeah. We get some like very early 2000 Matrix-y cyberpunk stuff. So a lot of the slips or space stations they visit have that like late 90s Euro trash techno punk look to them. And then when they do go into virtual reality, it's CG generated, but Matrix on a budget type look to it. So if you like that aesthetic, there's lots of it for sure.
Yeah, I guess in the final season, like I said, I'm not quite there in my rewatch, but at least for me, it was a little bit of a difficulty to get through. Maybe not on my rewatch. I may not find it as much, but I think when I'm watching it, when I watched it the first time, I just remember it was a slog to get through that final season. Cause like you said, it's just, they cut the budget and they're doing very random, cause everyone arrives at this system at different times. It's like Dylan's the last one to arrive. And then I think Harper was the first, and then Rade and Becca had gotten there at one point or another. There's been time that's passed. They've had to survive by doing odd jobs and doing things they may not be proud of. I think Rade's he's a drunk bouncer at that point. Not really much call for him, any military work. So he's just drinks and hangs out at the bar and fights when he has to, but otherwise just trying to make the days pass by. And Dylan has to reunite them again. So it's a redo of the beginning of the show where they have to unite everybody.
I didn't appreciate that the first time I saw it. Like, he loses his crew again because they all go through at the same time but come out at different points in time. They all hate him. They don't want to work with him. I'm like, what happened to the group? Like, they're all fighting with each other. But eventually he gets them back. And actually, there's some like really decent, like hard sci-fi in here where, you know, okay, these are eight worlds created around a artificial sun, because the Vedrans or somebody were trying to recreate Tarn Vedra, but I guess kept getting it wrong. But meanwhile, or two artificial suns rather, one of which is dying, which is creating these flares, which has wiped out all water in the system, which is why everything is all desert. And meanwhile, the sun beings are trying to destroy the universe and basically reset it. And we find out one of the characters is actually the son of the Tarn Vedra homeworld and can restore basically everything back to normal and wipe out the spirit of the abyss. So there's a lot going on in that fifth season. You just have to invest in it a little bit, but it is very interesting. It just takes a little while to get going, and you have to spend a lot of time in the bar and in the dusty streets that look like Tatooine there. But the rest of the show, they did really good work with the visual effects and the costumes with the money they had. It's clearly not up to Star Trek standards, but I think they had just a fraction of the budget. But it was very ambitious. They never didn't show something because they didn't have the money. They would just probably reuse the same clips of the show firing missiles several times over the course of a season. But yeah, very interesting, very good message. Obviously a challenged production, but they got there in the end.
Yeah, and the other piece of technology I wanted to mention is the Force Lances, which is the High Guards.
Very cool.
The High Guards. It's a combo range weapon and melee weapon. It's, I don't know if they stole it from Babylon 5, like the Rangers staffs, but it's this tube that you can shake and it turns into a big bow staff, but it also has, it's a point and shoot as well. So it's a lot of the people that they fight have guns, but Dylan just has this tube that he just points. It's almost like a magic wand. He points at people and shoots. And it also can do, I think it has, you can program it to do like mortar types or anti-missile type of things. Cause I think there's an episode where he sets up his Force Lance and it's knocking down incoming fire or something. So yeah, they're just a cool weapon and he uses them a lot to fight because there's a lot of melee battles on these ships, even though they have laser guns, they're still fighting. And
they get boarded a lot, which I almost forgot. Like one of my favorite things about the show. So this show is, if you're a classics major or like old literature, you will geek out in this show because every episode starts with a quote from some work of literature that is from the old Commonwealth, but obviously written either 10,000 years ago or 2,000, 3,000 years in our future. So you get a lot of quotes that you like, and then the author and the work, and you're like, oh, like that's actually an interesting, like meaningful quote, only it's completely fictional and made up for the show, but it relates to the episode somehow. And then, of course, Dylan being a High Guard are like the creme de la creme of the Commonwealth. They have a motto, which is Una Salus Victus, which comes from Virgil's Aeneid, Una Salus Victus Nalam Sperare Salutem, which means the sole hope of the damned is that they have no hope of salvation. So basically, if you have no hope of being saved, that's probably your biggest strength in the moment in the fight. And so you'll see that emblazoned like Una Salus Victus, or he'll say Una Salus Victus to other people. So yeah, it's there's a lot of really good world building in the show, given that they don't have the 70 year, however many years history of Star Trek to draw on. The fact that they were able to create this really rich world with 10,000 years of history very early on in the first season really speaks to the producers and certainly Robert Hewlett Wolff, who his original plan for the show, which you can read in the one act play, you can find it online, was that each one of the main characters from early on, Becca, Tyr, Harper, Trance, Dylan, Rev, Bem, they all became basically the leader of a different faction within the galaxy. So Harper loses his physical form, and this doesn't happen in the show. This is just what might have happened. Harper loses his physical form and basically becomes leader of the artificial intelligences. Tyr becomes leader of the Nietzscheans and raises a huge empire. Dylan becomes leader of the Commonwealth and leads a big empire. Becca basically becomes like the new force of order in the galaxy, taking over from the Abyss, and Trance becomes like the force of chaos in the galaxy. So you have these six huge forces that were the main characters that would have come to blows at some point, which I'm glad they didn't. I like it that it's a buddy show with a crew that likes each other and hangs out and solves problems together. That's all I really want in my sci-fi show. Just people who like each other solving problems together. Give me more of that, please. But yeah, if that sounds appealing to you, if the sci-fi world building sounds appealing to you, if the message of restoring hope and civilization to the universe sounds appealing to you, I think you'll definitely really enjoy this show.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. It's definitely it's a lot like Stargate, and maybe it's just a lot like the early 90s or the late 90s, early 2000s sci-fi, a lot more hope before Battlestar Galactica came in and made sci-fi. And I like Battlestar Galactica, don't get me wrong, but yeah, it's definitely a different
spaceship sadness, because it was just spaceship sadness and I couldn't watch it. It was too sad.
I enjoyed it, but yeah, it's definitely a different era. And yeah, I almost forgot to mention that these poems or sayings that happen for every episode. And I was thinking, it was like, if we were doing an Andromeda recap of every episode, I would like to hear some of these German titles like you do on Stargate. but there could be some interesting ones out there for those titles. Cause yeah, it's pretty cool world building, but then they go to so many different, it's like very planet of the week. The Andromeda's traveling on a mission to get these different worlds, and so they have to go to different planets and arrange an alliance or do, do a favor to get somebody to sign on to their to the treaty and whatnot. So,
oh no, the ambassador's been murdered. Who could have done it? Like, you get some of those episodes too. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Or there's, and yeah, Dylan finds a few girlfriends along the way, and then trying to think if there's Tyr has a couple of romances. I don't think Harper really does. He has a pining for Rami, and it's it's funny because he built the android Rami, but and is always kind of flirting with her.
And Becca becomes mother of all the Nietzscheans. Somehow.
Yeah. I think that's in the fifth season.
Bootstrap paradox. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, excellent show. You should check it out.
Yeah. Any other final thoughts, Victor, on anything Andromeda?
No. Una Salus Victus, everybody. If you like sci-fi and world building, check it out. I think you'll really enjoy it.
Awesome. Yeah, I don't think I have anything else either than, it's been fun to rewatch it. And this is probably my second time through, I think, but it's one I'll definitely check out in the future. So I think that is it for this episode of The Secrets of Movies and TV Shows. Now we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. What do you think about Andromeda? You can leave feedback on our Facebook page or on Twitter, or by sending an email to, I believe it's secrets@sqpn.com, by leaving us a comment on YouTube, or by visiting our channel in the StarQuest Discord community at sqpn.com/discord. And we'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make this show possible, including Jason O, Kate Z, Matthew B, Sailing L, and Kelly M. Their generous donations at sqpn.com help us to continue to create the secrets of movies and TV shows, and all the shows at StarQuest. And you can join them at sqpn.com/give. Once again, thanks Victor Lance for joining me and sharing the secrets of Andromeda.
Thanks, Jeff.
And I'm Jeff Hecker. Thank you for listening to Secrets of Movies and TV Shows.
Here's another show on the StarQuest Network you're sure to enjoy. The Secrets of Sacred Art. Find it wherever fine podcasts are found or at starquest.fm/art. We'd like to thank Patrick McCaffrey of Moonshadow Studios for editing this episode. To have your audio edited professionally and with care, check out more of Patrick's work at moonshadowstudios.biz. That's moonshadowstudios.biz.